From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Last weekend's battle on the streets of Virginia continued to provoke animated discussion and more. For more on that, we spoke with Professor Tony Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Thursday. So, you know, I said this as we were getting set up. You know, my concept for this whole thing is, wow. I don't know, a year and a half ago, when we first started really parsing what was happening leading into the election, back during the primaries, you had said then that there was a real possibility, you know, that the divisions in the country were so strong that they were stronger than any time since the Civil War, and perhaps even stronger than it could lead to Civil War. And now we're starting to actually see some kind of, like, tear in the social fabric that could take us there. And it's being stoked.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Definitely. In fact, the prospect of civil war cannot be taken off the table, although I am somewhat cautious in predicting it. I think that what we're looking at is a situation of profound chaos and ungovernability. In other words, the political class and its allies, for example, on Wall Street and the financial institutions and in the media and police and the military are unable to govern the country. And that is not just Trump, but even if Trump is replaced by Pence, the disintegration will continue and perhaps increase.
Yeah.
And even if in 2018, a prospect that I don't think is going to happen, the Democrats make significant inroads in the Senate and House, maybe even taking the Senate back, if that were to occur, it would not slow down the processes of disintegration.
Yeah, it's something else. There's something else going on here. Let me just interject just a little contextual, framing that. We have a situation where the condition of workers across the board in this country is more precarious than perhaps it's ever been, but certainly than it's been since the 1930s. There's no solution in sight. Everyone realizes that at this point in time. There is no plan to blow air back into the system to make it better. There's nothing. No one has really any hope except for Trump supporters who believe that he's going to somehow do it. But no one else believes it. And they're probably right. Where you would have a need for the strongest need, perhaps in the history of the country, for unity among the working class. And I mean that in the broadest possible sense of class, the 99%. Where you have that need, you are seeing instead these divisions being really stoked and really becoming manifest, because that is the only thing standing between the people marching on these wealthy folks with pitchforks and torches and rope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, I would say several things. I think that there's certain, conceptual problems with the, and I put quotes around this, the anti-white supremacist movements. First of all, which are, of course, in response to events in Charlottesville, Virginia. The first thing is the assumption that we are somehow on the verge of regime change, and the alt-right, as it is called, is in the vanguard of that. That is why the narrative about fascism and the need for national unity against fascism and white supremacy has begun to take hold, because of the hysteria created primarily by the mass media and indirectly by the corporate Democrats. Right. This idea that our democracy is being threatened by the alt-right, who are this mass movement armed and prepared to move violently to take state power. First of all, right. The alt-right, I don't care how you define it and how you count its numbers, is a sideshow and in many ways a joke and a convenient prop for those who wish to make the argument that we must now mobilize the nation against a possible fascist takeover.
I didn't even see them at the RNC. They were invisible at the RNC. So if they weren't there, where the hell are they?
That's right. That's right. And who are they? And is there a strength being purposefully and intentionally exaggerated for the sake of making the argument that that we are on the cusp of regime change? We are not on the cusp of regime change. What we are seeing are the multiple uses of political theater, political rhetoric, misinformation, and on and on and on to justify what began after the November 8th election. That is, the slow processes to remove Trump by any means necessary. So that's what we're looking at. I think a lot of this has to do with the 2018 election and ultimately with the 2020 election. The Democratic Party, the NGOs associated with it, the philanthropic foundations which fund the NGOs and so on, are really what are stoking what we see, I would say, as a false flag operation.
Yeah, so the framing you're talking about, first of all, there are some assumptions there. First assumption is that there is a democracy. When they talk about taking away our democracy, then the assumption is that there is one. That's first, right. And that's a false assumption, obviously. Mm-hmm. Second, if the alt-right is the vanguard of a fascist push that's coming to power, that assumes that fascism is not already in power. And if you ask, I would say, 90% of the human population on this planet, they would have to disagree, because they would ask, if that's not a fascist boot on the back of my neck, whose is it? So, you know, the foundational assumptions for that narrative are patently false. And what's interesting to me is these are foundational statements or beliefs of those who are actual or have held themselves out to be for years, and who I even believed were anti-fascist, communists, you know, socialists, and I don't mean of the quote-unquote democratic variety, but actual, you know, socialist revolutionaries, and I don't mean SRs either, I mean revolutionary socialists. And those people have always said the United States is not a democracy, it's a bourgeois dictatorship, that the United States is fascist. They've been saying since the end of World War II, as you've seen the U.S. pull fascists out of Italy and Germany and everywhere else, bring them into the state here, place them in power in Chile and, you know, everywhere. So now suddenly those things are no longer true. I guess there was a communist revolution that I slept through or something that purged, or a purge of all the fascists. And so now it's our democracy that's under threat from these, you know, brown shirts who we didn't see at the Republican convention. And when they have a march, the numbers, they were dwarfed by the so-called Antifa. There were 500 and maybe 1,000, 1,200 altogether after a national call. Hitler had more than that in the beer hall. He had 600 people come into the beer hall and thousands in the streets. That was before he went to jail.
Well, you know, there are two things that I would say, and I think these two things have been a part of our discussions over the months. First of all, I think you remember about a year ago, maybe a little more, when we were talking about Trump and Hillary Clinton during the presidential campaign. And I said, if mocking or satirically mocking the claim that Trump is a fascist, I said, if Trump is a fascist, then what does that make Hillary Clinton?
Right.
because on any number of issues involving foreign policy and foreign trade and neoliberalism and the neoconservatives, Trump was running considerably to the left of Hillary Clinton. And at that time, it seemed that Trump would block the path or slow down the path and then block the path to war with Russia through the Ukraine and the Baltic states. So we asked the question, if Trump is a fascist, what does that make Hillary Clinton? And that question remains answerless. No one, or most commentators have avoided defining who and what Hillary Clinton is, right, which is another way of asking the question, who and what are the corporate Democrats? What do they stand for? And can we at least pull back the veil of respectability that they wrap themselves in to see what their real essence is? I guess the second point that we made that goes along with that, who believes that the fascists have not been embedded in the U.S. state and in key positions of power in the state bureaucracy? Who believes that that has not been the case for now going on 5 decades? I mean, I don't know who, I mean, but that question is not asked, that fascists in this situation do not have to either run for office or organize an external putsch. They are already in power. The question is the relationship of the fascist, the genuine fascist, to Donald Trump. And why is it that almost to a person, they are calling for his ouster? And how do we explain the behavior of those politicians, let us say like John McCain or Lindsey Graham, who I consider to be very close to fascist elements within the foreign and military policy establishment of the United States? How do you explain that suddenly these are the so-called anti-fascists and anti-white supremacists? I would say, Don, there's something deeper, more complex, and more insidious going on here than the corporate media or most commentators, left, right, or center, are prepared to acknowledge.
You know, you say 5 decades, I assume, of fascism. I assume you're referring back to the assassination of John Kennedy, which was 54 years ago this November.
Yeah, but absolutely.
I would say perhaps 7 decades, because the National Security Act was signed in 1947. In fact, July 26th, I believe, if memory serves, so last month marked the 70th anniversary of that. And that was the enabling statute for the CIA and for all kinds of things. You know, it was the Patriot Act of its day that was, if the distance from the Bill of Rights to the Patriot Act is 10 steps, this was 4 or 5 steps, maybe 6, towards that 10. And and of course, this is in the aftermath of World War II, when the United States was openly courting, hiring, and deploying Nazis and fascists from Germany, Italy, from the bureaucracies there, from the deep states in those places, among the high military command, the spy agencies, all of that. They were being sent into Italy to deal with the elections there. They were being used to take over governments all over the world from there forward. And so I would argue that fascism has been here at least since then, and that's in the overt form.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I say 50 years ago is because I think the decision to fully shut down democracy in the United States was made in the wake of the Black Liberation Movement, the civil rights, and then the urban uprisings and so on, and the emergence of the Black Panther Party, the Revolutionary Union movement and the auto industries in Michigan and other places, the anti-war movement,
the
alienation of young people.
Yep.
And I think at that point, we have the political class and the state moving full force to embed in the state those who are committed in a long-term sense to the limitation of democracy, where ultimately in a number of commissions and high-profile reports, the Trilateral Commission, reports from Harvard University and academics and claims about a clash of civilizations, it becomes then a done deal. And I think any people that talk about a democracy have to at least talk about a liberal or bourgeois democracy in profound crisis, and as we see today, on life support.
Yeah, life support with about 6 feet of soil over the top of it.
Yeah.
All right, so, you know, we've got this problem, which is, you know, looking across the landscape, it's a kind of division that's been sown everywhere. Shia, Sunni, everyone against everyone in the Middle East and Southwest Asia, North Africa, for example. Also, the remainder of Africa, where you have factions that are, you know, evenly balanced and fighting each other. And we see it in Brazil and Argentina and Venezuela and everywhere else that they're able to sow this kind of division. And they try it. We saw an outburst of it attempted in Hong Kong a year or two ago, and we see it in Ukraine, and we see, you know, that is the future that is being mapped out right here at home in the belly of the beast for, you know, those who were the most loyal subjects of imperialism, because they benefited. The American dream here rested on all the booty that was dragged from everywhere else in the world. And now there's not enough of it for left to share with the rest of us here. And so rather than us saying, oh, now we get the game, let's go end it, they have us set upon each other, like we see in Charlottesville last week.
Yeah, and that is part of the, as you know, let me just say this, a big part of American politics is theater, acted out for the corporate media. And it's kind of this interesting dance between the elites of the political establishment and the corporate media and the non-governmental organizations and think tanks and all that type of thing to carry out this political theater. Having said that, the future is on the line. And, you know, I was just reading this or parts of this interview that Stephen Bannon, you know, one of Mr. Trump's top advisors, did with the American Prospect, the editor of it. And one of the things that Bannon is obsessed with or overly concerned with or deeply concerned with, I should say, is the U.S.-China economic competition. And he calls it economic warfare. And he says that if we do not gain a momentum in this competitive relationship in 5 years or at maximum 10 years, we will have lost not just the battle with China, but the battle to maintain and consolidate U.S. hegemony, economic hegemony in the world. Now, I think Bannon is hitting on something very, very important. And that relates to, I think, what you were just saying in my mind. That is the fact that the weakening of the capacity and will of the United States elites to unite around a common strategic policy vis-a-vis U.S. empire and U.S. imperialism, that failure of will and the failure to achieve unity means that growing possibilities for nations to resist U.S. Belligerency and threats and even actual intervention grows, which is a positive development for places like Venezuela, North Korea, Iran, who now see the United States as capable of belligerent threats, but not of consistently carrying out policies of intervention. And I think this goes for the whole world. As we have spoken before, the options for the United States in the world are very, very limited. People like Bannon seem to come off rationally, if we listen to them, in the sense that to wage the economic struggle with China, we have to retreat from the imperial, there must be imperial retreat, certainly from the neocon strategy of intervention and so on and so forth. I think this is a very critical moment. The contradictions within the Trump administration manifest contradictions within the deep state and within the establishment, especially the foreign policy establishment itself. No one has a solution or an answer to the problem of China, to the problem of Russia, to the problem of Syria, and on and on and on.
Yeah, he says we're at economic war with China. This is in that American Prospect interview that just came out. It's in all their literature, he says. They're not shy about saying what they're doing. One of us is going to be a hegemon in 25 or 30 years, and it's going to be them if we go down this path. And he's talking about, you know, exactly what you're referring to. And he goes on and says, to me, the economic war with China is everything, and we have to be maniacally focused on that. If we continue to lose it, we're 5 years away, I think 10 at the most, of hitting an inflection point from which we'll never be able to recover. So he says, basically, it's an existential threat to our hegemony. And, you know, we've got maybe 10 years, but more likely five, to actually, you know, settle our business and move forward. And talks about Korea as being a distraction. China's just looking at it and laughing. And that, you know, the thing that's interesting about this is... For somebody that has imputed to him comparisons to Lenin and such, he is largely focused on economics as the driver, the engine of history, politics, etc., which, you know, is, first of all, not the impression people have. People think that he's a white nationalist looking to restore white people to some, you know, throne somewhere. In fact, he's looking at economics as being the driver of history. That is a Marxist perspective, although I wouldn't call him one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, and he does, he says also in that interview that the alt-right, the ethno-nationalists are a joke.
Yep.
And in a lot of ways, we'd have to say he has to know, or if anyone knows, he would know.
Yep.
And he is concerned about the actual realpolitik in the world and the economic forces that are driving it. And he's on point. I mean, it's not just China, but it's China's relationships with other Asian nations and with European nations.
Mm-hmm.
He's very right. We're losing, and we've been losing, that competition for some time. You know, in a couple few years, China will be the number one nation economically in the world. And the United States is faltering. The thing about China, socially and politically, that contrasts with the United States is that the regime in the United States is facing a crisis of legitimacy. The regime in China is not.
That's correct.
American people are alienated from the political leadership of the nation. It is not the same in China. The American political class and the masses of people in the United States are united in one thing. They all are very pessimistic about the future of the United States as the leader of the, quote, free world. Chinese people, the Chinese nation, is very optimistic about its prospects going forward to the second half of the 21st century. Mm-hmm. I mean, it is day and night. It is a rising economic and military superpower and one in decline. Yep. And that's what defines, I think, in a lot of ways, the dialectic of world politics at this moment in history.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to bring this back to Bannon for a moment, because looking the way he's looking at China, you know, let's give it some proper context, because people have no idea who this guy is. And believe me, I'm not a fan. But this article, he dismissed the far right as irrelevant. He sidestepped his own role in cultivating it. In other words, opportunistically playing it while they were assembling constituencies. These guys are available because they got nobody. Mm-hmm. Ethno-nationalism, it's losers. This is a quote from him. It's a fringe element. I think the media plays it up too much, and we got to help crush it, you know, help crush it more. These guys are a collection of clowns, he said. Then he said, the Democrats, the longer they talk about identity politics, I got them. I want them to talk about racism every day. If the left is focused on race and identity, and we go with economic nationalism, we can crush them. I mean, that is, in essence, a Marxist statement.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously read Marx. He understands the role of the state in mobilizing resources to achieve certain ends. In that sense, I guess he has read Lenin. But, you know, to read Marx and Lenin in order to use them for purposes at odds with what
with workers.
Their purposes
right.
were.
That's right.
But nonetheless, when he talks about there is no military solution to the situation in North Korea, and it is a sideshow compared to the bigger battle with China over which nation will become the economic superpower in the second half of the 21st century. I mean, what he is saying, I think, indirectly, of course, when you put this in the context of the internal battles within the White House and so on, what he is saying is that someone in the establishment and in the White House or someone's is stoking this Korea situation in order to make to gain political standing within the elite, which is first and foremost the White House staff.
Right.
I mean, that's kind of what he's saying when he says this is a diversion. Well, who created this crisis?
Right.
And I don't know that I know the answer to that question. But what he is saying is this is a fake crisis. And what I think we have said in the past is that sometimes war and belligerency and threats of war are really tools of, of political battles domestically. And I think that's what the Korea thing was. And he is saying that is small stuff compared to the bigger battle of where the United States as an economic and military superpower will stand in 5 to 10 years.
And on that note, Professor Montero, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.